Governor DeSantis proposes a controversial new law that challenges the rights of protesters. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. DeSantis laid out tougher penalties for protesting, like going after people just for being at the protest if property is damaged. Civil rights groups question whether it's constitutional. Could it still pass the legislature? Also, we'll hear from a Palm Beach County teacher about her first day with students back in the classroom. And finally,
it really was the Labor Day hurricane that kind of sparked my interest in writing this book, and I just came across it. I think it was during Hurricane Irma coverage.
We'll revisit one of the worst hurricanes to hit the United States, as it's told in the historical novel The Last Train to Key West by Chanel Cleeton. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Protesting in Florida could fundamentally change in the years to come. Governor Ron DeSantis yesterday proposed sweeping new legislation that could bring felony charges to protesters.
We are going to impose criminal penalties for violent or disorderly assemblies, and that'll be a third-degree felony. We will also require a felony if you incapacitate any of the roadways.
His plan also includes cutting any state aid or grants to local government with proposals to, quote, slash their police budgets. Civil rights activist groups have raised concerns about freedom of speech and the right to organize, and mayors across South Florida have raised concerns about local control of their budgets. The Sun Sentinel's Mario Ariza joins us now to discuss. Mario, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Luis. I really appreciate it.
Also, I want to mention that we did invite both Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez and Governor Ron DeSantis to join us on the program today. The offer still stands for a later date. All right, so Mario, what was the governor's reasoning to propose this legislation now? We're talking months after the protest started, the protest against police brutality.
Well, Luis, the predicate for the proposal of this bill is a concern over law and order at the moment. There is a perception that in the wake of the uprising after the George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, there's been some sort of degradation of the sort of law and order that we used to enjoy beforehand. But if you look at a data analysis that's been done by Princeton University of most of the protests, they found that 93% of the actions after the death of George Floyd were generally peaceful. And so there are questions from both legal scholars and advocates about the predicate and the necessity for this bill. And some are saying that it's just kind of a naked political ploy. But at the same time, if you look at a Quinnipiac poll from September 3rd, you'll note that Floridians do seem to be very concerned about law and order. They rank it as their number two concern after the economy and above the coronavirus.
So this proposal from the governor, it's called Combating Violence, Disorder, and Looting and Law Enforcement Protection Act. There's a lot included in this legislation. Let's cover a few points here. What could happen to protesters if property is damaged?
Well, it's mainly turning property damage from a misdemeanor into a felony, right? So a felony in Florida means more than 1 year jail time generally. It also means that you're going to lose your voting rights. You're facing disenfranchisement. You won't be able to own a gun. And in a certain cases, it's saying that there's mandatory minimum sentences for striking law enforcement officers. Most distressingly, it also offers a predicate of being held pending trial for anybody who is charged with any of these offenses. So you would have to explain to the magistrate judge why you deserve to be let go. Right now, if you're involved in a protest and there is property damage or, you know, there is some sort of disorderly conduct, the presumption is that you should be let go rather than you should be held.
The legislation doesn't suggest a protester would need to be caught in the action. They just have to be there, right? That's, I think, one of the controversial aspects of this.
Correct, yes. And we should note now that we don't have the actual text of the legislation. We have the proposal that's been floated by the governor and his press release. But in that proposal, it's just essentially says you don't have to be the one participating in the disorderly conduct. You don't have to be the one, participating in the destruction of property. You just have to be present at a protest where that occurs. And, you know, protests are by nature sometimes fluid actions, something that was very civil and well-organized, like the one that we saw in Fort Lauderdale on March 31st that devolved into May 31st between police and protesters, was up until the point where it got, you know, pretty heated, a largely peaceful demonstration.
So Governor DeSantis, during his press conference yesterday, was flanked by members of law enforcement in a show of unity. You spoke with Broward Sheriff Union President Jeff Bell. How did he respond to the governor's proposal?
Yeah, Jeff liked it. Jeff is on board with the proposal, and he thinks it's going to make police jobs easier and, you know, create more safety for officers. And so the general sense from law enforcement has been that this is, you know, a good step in the right direction.
What concerns have protesters raised to you about their right to organize, though?
Sure. Well, specifically, there's two concerns at the moment. One is this part of the bill that would treat organizing a protest where something like this happens, you'd get treated as a member of a criminal syndicate with what is called RICO liability. So if I organized a protest against, mask wearing, right, and something happened at that protest, I would be liable then. And so that's a big issue. The second is, you know, the protesters who are doing this, I spoke to one who had already 11 arrests at these protests for things like walking down the street or quote-unquote disorderly conduct. It doesn't seem like it's going to deter them. There's a lot of fear, but they see their cause as just.
So earlier this morning, we spoke with Micah Kubik. He's the executive director of the Florida ACLU. We asked him about the constitutionality of the legislation and his concerns that the organization has for this.
As the bill that he proposes, as it stands, is it constitutional? Do you believe it holds up in court?
So I think so far we've really just seen a very brief summary of what he intends. We've not seen the full bill. But even with that, I think there's no question that it is unconstitutional, defies common sense, violates basic principles of right and wrong. It denies bail to folks who attend protests that are considered by some subjective, arbitrary standard to be disorderly. It gives motorists who kill protesters the ability to act with impunity. It punishes local governments that make decisions for themselves about how to best address questions of public safety. I think all of those things really violate the First Amendment, violate the rights of protesters, and on top of that are precisely the wrong statement to be making at this time in American history when we should be marching towards racial justice. Instead, the governor wants to pull us backwards.
What does the law say right now about protesting when it comes to property damage, but also, for example, blocking roadways? What does the law say right now?
So we already have laws against violence. We already have laws against property damage. We already have laws against disorderly conduct. We already have laws against just about anything that is actually a public safety concern. But public safety is not the point of this package of proposals, because if it were, there would be no need for them. Those laws already exist. This is instead designed to punish folks who show up and speak out, and even more than that, designed to discourage people from showing up in the first place. If you can be punished, if you can be jailed, if you can be denied bail, if you can be denied employment by the state for the rest of your life, just for showing up to an event that someone somewhere decides is disorderly, that discourages people from speaking out. It discourages people from petitioning their government. It discourages people from demanding better from public employees. And all of that is really a shame.
Have you heard of any legislation like this anywhere in the country?
Yes, we've certainly seen bills like this floated in a number of places, especially the provisions about motorists being able to kill protesters and face no consequences whatsoever. Bills like that have been filed in a number of states. And other of these proposals have been floated at various points over the last couple of years. They have been uniformly criticized, derided, found to be just devoid of any sense of morality. And I think that's especially true here, where over the last summer, we've seen a number of places where, in fact, motorists have killed protesters because they disagreed with what they were saying.
Does the ACLU plan to take any legal action if that bill passes in the next legislature?
So we still have a long ways between now and March when the legislature comes back, February when the legislature comes back. If the bill is introduced and actually undermines the First Amendment the way it is proposed today, we will absolutely take action. We will fight for the rights of Floridians around this state. Not just to protect their First Amendment rights, but to protect Floridians from police brutality and to protect Floridians from an authoritarian government.
Have you reached out to the governor's office and has anybody communicated with you about this proposal?
No.
So what is the advice that the ACLU is giving to protesters, again, considering some of the things that are in this proposal?
Sure. So we always tell protesters to know their rights, to know that they can, in fact, engage in peaceful protest. They can, in fact, show up and have their voice be heard. We've seen lots of examples this summer of protesters who had their rights violated by police, who, in fact, were the victims of police violence at protests. We've all seen the stories about people being assaulted, shot with rubber bullets, tear gas. Oftentimes in circumstances where the only thing that was happening was protesters were using names for police that they didn't like. So we encourage protesters to know their rights. We have a piece about this on our website at aclufl.org where folks can go to learn about their rights at protests, and they should know what those are. In the meantime, we all have to be holding law enforcement and government accountable for what they do. And we've got a long ways to go on that front in this state and in this country.
Again, that was Micah Kubik, Executive Director of the Florida ACLU. And we are talking with the Sun Sentinel's Mario Ariza. Yesterday, Governor Ron DeSantis introduced new legislation focused on protest and funding of law enforcement agencies. And you can read more of that on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Mario, coming back to you, you know, we were talking briefly there about the other part of the governor's proposal. Again, this related to the defunding of police. Governor DeSantis said that the state would cut grants or aid to any local government that slashes the budget for law enforcement. Did he elaborate if that means any reduction or reallocation of resources?
To my knowledge, we don't have a lot of specificity as to this particular provision in the bill, which is, you know, kind of unfortunate because there's a lot of municipalities at the moment who are having to make very hard choices about their municipal budget because of COVID-19. So in a time when there's a budget crunch, and, you know, I believe the Herald was reporting yesterday that the city of Miami is planning on getting rid of 23 civilian employees in its police department. City of Fort Lauderdale has discussed a little bit about that. But to my knowledge, nobody in Broward is cutting their police budget at the moment. But, you know, it's a general concern that we may not be able to provide all the services that we are used to providing at the municipal level because of a budget crunch due to COVID-19. And here, you know, it seems like the governor and the state house may be stepping in to say, hey, no, you can cut other things, but you can't cut police.
Does the governor have support from the legislature on this proposal?
Well, that's still unknown, but, you know, the fact that he was flanked by the speaker designate of the House and the president designate of the Senate says, you know, a lot in terms of making this legislative priority. We'll see. You know, it's possible that there may be more libertarian factions of the Florida delegation in the House that don't necessarily support sections of this bill. We'll see if it makes it out of committee. I'm sure there's going to be spirited debate, and it's going to be something that we should definitely keep a close eye on.
I mean, why now? You know, and really talking about the politics of this, we're weeks away from an election. We know DeSantis's allegiance to the president, but why this? Why now?
That's a great question, Lewis. I mean, I can only speculate. The law and order message is one that does pull well. It is a concern that people have. But, you know, there are also larger issues that these folks may not necessarily be wanting to discuss at the moment, right? We've got DeSantis is handling the pandemic, and there's lots of questions about that at the moment. And then there's also the general state of the economy, right? Florida's unemployment is still very large. There's a lot of people suffering. There's a lot of folks hungry. And if, you know, you were to hold the election tomorrow, it's unclear if it would be a referendum on those two things or if on law and order. And there's been a lot of money spent on trying to paint one party as the party of law and order and the other party is the party of anarchy and disorder. So, you know, it's definitely got a campaign message sort of built into it, and one does have to ask questions about the timing. But, you know, it's a little bit hard to answer without hearing it from the horse's mouth himself.
And just briefly, because we heard from Mr. Kubik, again, just the question of will this hold up in court?
Yeah, that's a great one. It really depends on what sort of judge you get, right? You can imagine in the more conservative counties in Florida where there are elected circuit court judges, you know, they may not necessarily see this as a problem. Or if they don't see this as a problem and the case goes to appeal, right, like it could cause a lot of undue misery and harm to people who work peacefully putting the right or exercising the right to protest. You know, and you also have to ask the question, like, if the shoe's on the other foot and there's a Democratic governor, could this law be used against folks who were protesting against the Democratic governor imposing a coronavirus lockdown or a mask mandate, right? It does seem to really broaden the police powers of the state against the legitimate expression of dissent.
A lot to uncover there and plenty of time to discuss it. We've been talking with the Sun Sentinel's Mario Ariza. Mario, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Louis. You have a great day.
You too. And again, you could catch up more on Mario's reporting on this issue on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, some students and teachers are back in the classroom in Palm Beach County this week. We're going to hear a teacher's concerns about education during COVID. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thousands of students are back in Palm Beach County classrooms this week. The return to in-person schooling has been hotly debated. Some teachers have called for removal of the district superintendent, Donald Flannoy. There's also a class action lawsuit filed against the district by teachers who claim they're not in a safe working environment. Now, we've offered Superintendent Flannoy multiple opportunities to be on the program. We also reached out to school board member Dr. Deborah Robinson to join. Both declined the opportunity or haven't yet responded. That offer still stands for a later date. Yesterday, we spoke with Karen Walter. She's a science teacher and department co-chair at William T. Dwyer High School in Palm Beach County. She discussed the first day back and the experience of teaching students in the classroom and at home. Well, Karen, I mean, I want to start with this. You are back on campus, but not all students are back on campus, even though today in Palm Beach County, some will be returning. Tell me this first day, what happened?
Well, it was, I do have some anxious teachers, no doubt, and I'm sure the administrators, and I'm the department chair, so I come in early. And there aren't that many students, quite honestly. There's just a few. I've been into a few of my science classrooms. I had 7 in my first period. I've only done 1 period so far. But everything, seems to be fine, actually.
I mean, normally, what's a typical day? Without the pandemic, what's a typical day for you?
That's a 24-student class.
Hmm. So as a teacher, Karen, how do you feel about having students back in the classroom?
Well, I often tell all of my students that I work in 2 germ factories. I usually get sick once or twice a year, and that's my only concern. I have been on campus without students here. It's just, you know, me and my teachers, and, you know, it's actually nice because we can talk to each other. And, well, this is a little different because of these students, but with the low number, I really feel like it's manageable.
Do you feel safe?
No. I mean, yes, no. I'm very ambivalent about that for sure. Do I know that my chances of getting COVID are higher with students in the classroom? Yes. Does that scare me? Yes, a little. I am diabetic and I am 63. So that's kind of like borderline stuff about complications from COVID. But it's kind of like I told my teachers, we as science teachers know how viral transmission occurs and we can intervene. So because we're going to be very, 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 very careful.
I'm trying to figure this out. I want to like picture it in my mind. Is it like a regular classroom and you're teaching kids in that classroom, but then, you know, the other kids are just watching online, or do you have to do two different types of teaching?
I did try to do both at the same time, and I put the Google Meet as the format, the platform that we use. I put it up on my screen so that the students that were sitting in the classroom could see the students that were online, and I made funny jokes about what they were doing up on the screen, you know, so that they felt like they were included. And then, of course, the students sitting in the classroom also had things to say. I think they heard it. They responded, you know, with the facial expressions. They responded like they could hear what the students were saying. So it was interesting, let's say that.
But the students in the classroom, are they also on computers, or they're in a traditional setting with you?
They went ahead and opened their computers. I told them if they wanted to take notes with a pen and paper, you know, like a composition book, that would be fine too, whatever they feel more comfortable with. Almost all of them opened their computers. They were watching me, and they had their Chromebooks open, and the PowerPoint was projecting on the overhead. But every now and then I would switch back over to the Meet so that they could see all the little screens.
What's that like? You have students in a classroom, but they're watching you through a screen anyway.
I think as teachers, we're kind of used to doing this dance where we just do what we do. There's nothing that could have prepared us for this first day. There's nothing.
I want to get a sense, too, of what the school has done to keep everybody safe. What's changed physically in the classroom and the school to make sure everybody is safe?
They did require us to do a seating chart so that evidently the county is going to do contact tracing, the health department. I'm all good with that. Contact tracing should be done. So we have to give them a seating chart every day, where the students were, who are they close to, and that kind of stuff. The plexiglass has only been installed in high traffic areas, the individual classrooms, at least in my building. It has not been installed yet. Some of my teachers took matters into their own hand, and they put like shower curtains or clear vinyl around their desk. And I mean, I'm wearing my mask, and I have all kinds of wipes. And the principal got masks for the students. So this morning we gave each student a pack of five. I mean, I have a shield also. I did not wear it this morning because it was uncomfortable. So if I get out and around students more, then I probably would put it on. I kind of surveyed my students this morning, and some of them came today to see what it was like. I think they've already changed their mind. So they have opted already not to stay in the physical classroom.
So you have students that after today said, nope, I'm going to go back home.
Yes, I had two.
Wow.
Two of the seven that were in there said, today's it for me. I'm going back home.
We're talking with Karen Walter. She's a science teacher and department co-chair at William T. Dwyer High School in Palm Beach County. And Palm Beach County is already allowing some of their students back to campus. We're finding out how that's working out and if it's going to last, as other districts like Broward and Miami-Dade are still working on their plans for reopening campus. I wanted to ask you about this, the story about the teachers who filed a class action lawsuit against the district for reopening campuses. Are you a part of that?
Yes, I am.
Remind us of what the lawsuit is asking of the school district.
basically to close the schools down again. Evidently, the Constitution of Florida states that we are supposed to have a safe teaching environment. And with a pandemic, you know, sweeping the world, we don't, that's the whole basis of it. We do not have a safe working environment.
Yeah. Were you also part of the group of teachers who asked for Dr. Fenoy to step down?
I'm part of CTA, but I was not part of that group. I quite honestly feel that everybody in the district's hand was pushed. And if I were going to lay blame, I'd place it on the governor's desk.
How much do you think it's pressure from parents? How much do you think it's pressure from Tallahassee, from politicians?
I think it's mostly from Tallahassee. I think there's a small contingency of very vocal parents that did want to have that choice to send their child back to school, and I respect that. I mean, I don't think I would in this situation if I had a child that was school age, but I had no choice.
You know, looking forward, I mean, you've been doing this a while, and I'm wondering your thoughts about the future, because we don't know. We don't know when there's going to be a vaccine, and when that comes out, you know, how many people will be able to get it right away, or if it's going to be effective. I mean, there's so many questions. How long do you think we can do this? How long can we run schools like this?
Well, virtual is really the only, you know, thing that I can think of right now. I think we do need an effective vaccine administered to a large amount of the population so that we can approach herd immunity, if there even is that, because we're not even sure if there's herd immunity with this virus. We might have, you know, people getting it repeatedly.
Exactly. No, exactly. I've heard about teachers who've just quit. They left.
And we had several.
You've known about some of them, right?
Well, one was in my department. Fortunately, before the freeze, we were able to hire another teacher, and I'm very thankful for that. Otherwise, it would have really put a big pressure on the rest of the department. We do have several vacancies right now. There were a bunch that retired or just quit.
And how do you feel? Do you feel like you can continue to do this, or does that cross your mind? Maybe I got to get out of this. I can't teach anymore.
Well, I do need to get to 65. So the insurance is outrageously expensive, as I'm sure many people are aware. And I have great insurance through the district. With a pre-existing condition, I need to get to 65.
Gotcha.
That's my goal.
I understand that. You know, there are parents who say they need their kids back in school because they can't be at home and they don't have that choice. How do we resolve that problem? How, you know, without making enemies of two groups, you know, how do we help those parents but also protect the teachers?
So I believe that there are some teachers that are more than willing, especially teachers of the youngsters. I teach high school. It's a very different ball game. I think that some parents may have sent children to school because they are afraid that they might be getting into trouble at my level. But I think at the lower levels, with the parents that need to get back to work, and I know and I really respect that they need to get back to work. Their lives have been very disrupted by this pandemic. If we have teachers that are willing and able to do this, and then the other ones can be online virtual teachers.
I wanted to know, Karen, what have students said to you about all of this?
Even though my students are older, they're still children. So I am doing what I can to alleviate any stresses that they feel. They wanted to talk. They wanted to get to know each other. They wanted to mingle. And even though they were separated by a good, you know, good space, we did have a couple of discussions, very quick ones, because they don't know each other that well yet. So I try to put them at ease, but still let them know that we have to do these safeguards. And for everybody, for everyone involved, that's the statistical reality of it. I think that's the scary part when you start just looking at the numbers.
That was Karen Walter, a science teacher at William T. Dwyer High School. And if you're a teacher or a parent or a student, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial or email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. We'd like to hear your thoughts about kids back in the classroom. What do you think about that? Well, still to come, we're going to meet this month's Sundial Book Club author and discuss the infamous Labor Day hurricane of 1935. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In 1935, one of the most powerful hurricanes to strike the United States hit the Middle Keys. It killed hundreds, including a large group of World War I veterans. That's the backdrop for the novel The Last Train to Key West by Chanel Cleeton. It's the September pick for the Sundial Book Club. Chanel has written about different eras in her historical fiction. We recently talked to her about what drew her to 1935 in the Florida Keys, but we started by asking her about the three heroines of her story. This story follows the lives of three different women, so you have three very distinct characters with three very different voices. So how did you develop the personas for Helen, Myrta, and Elizabeth?
Well, for me, with my characters, I really sort of start from the perspective of the world that they inhabit. So with each character, I try to think about the environment they're in and how those factors, you know, the socioeconomic factors, the political issues going on at the time, especially since I write so much about women, you know, women's issues going on at the time, I think about how those things would shape their characters. So for example, with Myrta, I was really drawn to her Cuban heritage, which obviously is something I share with her, and wanting to understand how, for example, the revolution of 1933 would have affected her family and sort of shaped her position in the world. With Helen, I really looked at her marriage and how the marriage affected her and her position in society and her ability to kind of move freely around the world she inhabited. And also the Great Depression, you know, that plays such an important role in the book. It's set in 1935, and both Helen and Elizabeth are really struggling from the Depression, and the Great Depression had a huge toll on women. Definitely proportionally, they suffered more than, you know, even men did when you looked at the areas of their lives that were affected. And so I really wanted to draw that out with my characters. You know, with Helen, you see it from her perspective as a waitress. With Elizabeth, you see it from the perspective of someone who comes from an affluent family, who's lost quite a bit in the Great Crash and is really having to start over in an unfamiliar world. So I find that those experiences really help me get into the mindset of my characters and give them those distinct voices.
What are the themes that ultimately tie these characters' personalities together?
I think they're all women who are very much trying to find their way in a world that is often unforgiving, and particularly so with the Depression and then the hurricane bearing down on them. They're women who have a strong sense of survival, who are very much looking to establish their sense of self and to find a degree of autonomy, you know, that's able to be developed at that time period, which was certainly challenging. So it's very much that they're on a journey of kind of finding themselves and getting to a point in their lives that they want to be.
And when you were writing this, did you write each story separately and then tie them together? Or kind of like with the reader, you know, were you bouncing back and forth between stories?
I do bounce back and forth when I write. I will be honest, as a writer, sometimes you'll work on a scene and it's a little refreshing to be able to switch to a different perspective or to kind of move to a different point in the book. So I do really like that about working with different POVs and different characters, that I can kind of move around. Maybe when I feel like I want to change things up a bit or I'm in a different mindset that day that I'm writing. So I pretty much wrote it as readers would read it. Sometimes I will skip a little out of order if perhaps I'm feeling a particular scene that day. You know, I tend to kind of use my books as a little bit of a catharsis where I can put a lot of emotions on the page. So if I'm having a bad day and I maybe want to tackle a scene that allows me to play with those emotions, I definitely do so.
You know, for this book, you're in the Great Depression, but the characters experienced it from, again, three different places, Havana, New York, and Key West. How do the women's experiences in each of these cities during the Great Depression give a unique insight, you know, for the reader about those characters?
Well, I think there are a few different things that I really took away about the Great Depression. I think one was just the global nature that it affected people. So understanding that Mirtha being in Cuba was still very much affected by the economic unrest in the United States. And I think, you know, we talk about globalism so much nowadays, but it's always interesting to be able to look back in history and see those kind of global international influences. So that was definitely one part of it. I also think it really spoke to the insecurity of the women in terms of financial insecurity, physical insecurity, you know, the struggles they faced finding a place for themselves in this ever-changing and very volatile world that they were in. And that was definitely something as I was researching, going through the historical record, you see that marriage rates went way down. And for many women, that was a source of great security. There was quite a bit of public opinion saying that women shouldn't be taking jobs from men. And so if you were a single woman, you had that struggle of needing to support yourself, but society saying that men should be filling those jobs since there was such a lack of them. So it was things like that that really gave me a sense of the time period and what it must have been like for a woman to be living and trying to kind of take care of herself in that time period.
And you have, Mirtha, of course, coming from Cuba, but you had Elizabeth coming from New York, Helen struggling in this abusive relationship in Key West. Mirtha is related to characters from another book, right?
Yes, she is. Mirtha is the aunt of two of my heroines from my first two historical fiction novels, Next Year in Havana and When We Left Cuba. So it's kind of going back in time a little bit on this Perez family that I've created and whose story I've been telling through these books and sort of seeing what happened before and what their ancestors' experiences were like.
So where did Elizabeth and Helen come from? Where were the inspirations for those characters?
Helen really came to me first of all the characters. That's the reason her chapters bookend the novel. You meet her first and then she closes things out. And I really just had her voice in my head all along. She just spoke to me very strongly. And I think, you know, she really embodies what so many women in that time period were struggling with. And also there were definitely parallels with some of the discussions we were having as I was writing the book about violence toward women, certainly the Me Too movement, and kind of understanding both maybe how far we've come and how far we have to go in terms of women's position in society.
You know, the story takes place in the Keys, as I said, during the Depression era, but it happens to take place during the week of the Labor Day hurricane, one of the worst hurricanes to hit the United States. What was your interest in this event? Why that hurricane?
It really was the Labor Day hurricane that kind of sparked my interest in writing this book. And I just came across it, I think it was during Hurricane Irma coverage. There was a mention of some of the strongest and deadliest storms to hit the United States. And I grew up in Florida, you know, was educated in Florida for a large part of my formative years. And it was a storm I had never heard of. And I was really surprised by that, to have been in the state and for the impact it had on the state to be kind of forgotten to some extent. And so I was really intrigued when I first heard about it. And then when I heard of the plight of the World War I veterans who were down there working in the camps, building the overseas highway, and, you know, kind of, I had always sort of thought of the World War I veterans as being, you know, this generation that was venerated for their military service. And then to see that they weren't actually treated that way in the aftermath was also really illuminating for me. So I think there were just so many fascinating intersections with that, and also Henry Flagler's legendary Overseas Railroad and the connections to Cuba. I just kind of started to get this little spark, and I knew it was an idea I wanted to pursue.
And you're from Florida, and I'm wondering, I mean, you must have been through a lot of different hurricanes. Is there one that sticks out to you, one experience?
You know, I've been pretty fortunate in the sense that I've not been in, you know, immediate physical danger with a hurricane. I've certainly been in the lead up of, do we evacuate? Do we board up windows? And kind of that anxiety and stress that I think we all deal with every year when it's hurricane season. And I wanted to explore that in the book a bit. I mean, I remember as a kid, I lived farther north, but obviously hearing about Hurricane Andrew, we had family down there, listening to it on the radio and just being so kind of frightened by the power of nature and the impact it can have on people's lives. So I think that was probably something that was kind of always rolling around inside me that I wanted to explore as a writer and kind of understand a bit better.
I'm speaking with Chanel Cleeton. She's the author of the Sundial Book Club September selection, The Last Train to Key West. The novel takes readers to the Florida Keys in the Great Depression through the stories of three very different women. You could join the book club and be part of the discussion by going to Facebook and searching Sundial Book Club. You spent time in the Florida Keys doing research, right, for this book?
I did, yes.
Tell me a little bit about, you know, when you're doing research like this and you're looking at a time, you know, a point in time that was a long time ago, and there might not even be much evidence left of what happened. But what were you looking for? Where were you going? Who were you talking to?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that was really helpful for me was getting a renewed sense of the geography of the Keys. You know, growing up in Florida, I had certainly been before on vacation and that sort of thing. But it wasn't until I was really working on the book and on the very tight timeline of the storm, of where it hit at certain points and what impact that had, that it helped to go down there and see it from that perspective. I mean, so much of the terrain of the Keys makes it very difficult when you're talking about evacuation or going to higher ground, particularly back then when the highway wasn't fully up and running. You know, you had ferries going between Keys. The railroad was kind of the only, you know, means you really had consistently. And so it just kind of added to that immediacy of the danger that my characters felt and to some of the challenges, you know, as they're physically moving around the Keys with the storm bearing down on them and the impact that that would have. And it was just really interesting too. I mean, obviously you're right. A lot of, you know, things have been built up and it's certainly not exactly the same as it was back then, but there are really useful mile markers. And they're actually, you know, there's the big hurricane memorial in Isla Mirada. And then there are also markers where the different camps are. And even though the markers are kind of in now residential sections, it was just really interesting to stand in those places and get a sense that this is where my characters lived and this is a bit of what they experienced. So it was definitely, you know, a fascinating experience. I went down after Hurricane Irma and I certainly saw, you know, the rebuilding effort that was going on then. And it definitely put in perspective, you know, how challenging it must have been to rebuild after the 35 storm without some of the modern technology that we have now.
I want to come back to the three protagonists again, Helen, Myrta, and Elizabeth. And, you know, one of the common threads for them is taking control of their lives. And not just in their personal circumstances, but of course, because of the storm, they have to take control. And yet, all of them have at least a man with them as they do it. Is this a romance book?
I wouldn't say it's a romance in the conventional genre conception that we use when we talk about a genre romance novel, but it certainly has three love stories. I wrote romance before I wrote historical fiction, and I really enjoy kind of exploring the emotional connections between my characters, particularly in heightened situations. I mean, I think love is one of those universal emotions, you know, whether it's love between friends, love between romantic partners, love for, you know, a child or a relative. And I like to explore that. You know, I think that often those are where we see kind of the hopeful moments emerge in stories. And so I do like to explore that in my writing. And I thought it was interesting as I was writing the book and I was trying to kind of envision the characters adapting to the storm, I began to see little bits of shifts in the relationships. Or for example, Myrta coming from Cuba was far more experienced with hurricanes than her husband was. And up until that point, she'd been a little bit shyer in the relationship and he had certainly been perhaps a little more of a traditional role that she kind of looked to. But when the storm came, I found he was asking her, you know, much more frequently what kind of implications, you know, the storm was going to have for them, what they should do, where they should go, because she had that experience. So I like playing with that a little bit and finding ways for my characters to assert themselves and for the women to certainly be able to share their expertise and their knowledge with the men.
The other thing, too, I'm wondering about is, and I remember last year we spoke with a romance author, and one of the most important things she said is that, look, in a romance story, it's got to end happy. You know, everybody's got to get what they want, you know. And so I'm wondering, as you're writing this and you have three different characters, you know, is it important, you know, that the characters in the end get what they want, or is it that they get what they need?
That's a great question. And I would say for me, it really depends on the book. I certainly have some books that have not ended in a traditional happily ever after, as we say in the romance community. I have some books that I've chosen to. So it really just depends on the story and where I feel like the story is taking me. With this book, I really wanted to explore the idea of something beautiful coming out of something tragic and kind of leave my readers on that hopeful ending. And so I think that's really why I was driven to write the characters and the relationships the way I was. But I really think it just depends on the novel for me. I mean, with a romance, obviously, yes, you follow the happy ending because readers are certainly owed that in the genre, and that is the expectation. But with historical fiction, I definitely play around with that a little bit more.
So looking at your biography, you studied international relations. You got a master's degree in global politics from London. You received your Juris Doctor from the University of South Carolina School of Law. As a student, what did you envision for your life? What did you want to do?
I will say this has been a little bit unexpected. My passion was definitely international politics and kind of security studies, and life just sort of took me in a different direction. I've always been a really big reader, and so I think that love of books definitely kind of put me on this path, and it turned out to be sort of the perfect career for me. So it's been a very wonderful thing that surprised me, but that I've been very happy with.
When did you start writing?
You know, I would say probably around law school is when I really seriously started writing. I will confess, I was not a happy law student. It wasn't a good fit for me. And so I think having that outlet and also being able to kind of turn my eyes to a different career path kind of got me through law school and graduation, and then gave me that opportunity to kind of pursue something else that felt like a better fit. So it's been, I guess, almost 10 years now that I've really seriously, you know, been writing.
Your website is so much fun. You know, besides the discussion about this book and all of your books, you also have recipes in there. This is so much fun. You have a recipe for black beans and rice, for lechon asado, also for the famous Key West key lime pie, for Rum Runner. I wondered, you know, when you arrived, I would say this, actually. When I arrived in Florida, I came from Puerto Rico. I remember how important food was in our family. It's so important in our family. What did it mean for you growing up?
Oh, it was very influential. I grew up in a Cuban household. My family, they're Cuban exiles, and my grandparents lived with us. So I very much grew up with my grandmother cooking Cuban food, you know, every night. And back then, you know, I didn't live down in Miami. I lived in North Florida. And so we didn't really have a lot of Cuban restaurants. And so really that's where I kind of had my connection to the culture and to the food, was through my grandparents kind of recreating all of those memories and those meals and all of those special things. So it's definitely, you know, when I think of home or I'm homesick or having a hard day, those are very much like the comfort foods I think that I sort of gravitate to. So I love sharing that with my readers. And I have so many Cuban readers now that they'll kind of share the variations that they have with the recipes, you know, with picadillo, do we do raisins? Do we not do raisins? Do we put cinnamon? So it's really fun to kind of hear everyone taking different takes on the dishes and what their memories are connected to them.
Is there another story for Mirta, Elizabeth, or Helen?
That's a great question. I don't have anything specific centering them at the moment planned, but I will say that I'm working on a book that'll be out probably in 2022, and Mirta will play a role in that novel. It's not exclusively her story, but because she is related to my Perez family, we'll see her come back as we kind of meet some more Perez ancestors and kind of delve into a different time period in their lives.
In any of your characters, but you know, I'm curious about, you know, Helen and Elizabeth, how much of you is in your characters? And are you in any of those characters?
Oh, that's a good question. I think as a writer, probably there's a piece of me in almost all of my characters. I find that really helps me to have something to grab onto when I'm trying to get inside their heads and understand the stories. You know, with Elizabeth in particular, she was just a really fun character to write. When I'm writing heavier historical fiction, I really like to kind of balance the narratives out with little bits of levity. And she had such an outspoken, kind of sassy character. If you've read my books before, you know that I'm a little bit drawn to that. She kind of reminded me of Beatrice in When We Left Cuba. And I really like to explore kind of that power of femininity and, you know, her just sort of go-getter attitude that she has. And so you see it in kind of her flirtation on the train and the fact that she's come all the way down on Henry Flagler's Overseas Railroad from New York at this young age to sort of solve some of the problems that her family's facing. So I was really drawn to kind of her gumption and how she sort of tackles the world. And then Helen, I think, just really, you know, she has such a poignant story for me. I mean, I mentioned that she's the one that kind of came to me first and whose voice was just the loudest in my head. And I really feel like at the end of the day, she was kind of the heart of the book and her experiences and what comes out after the storm.
That was Chanel Cleeton, author of the September title for the Sundial Book Club, The Last Train to Key West. You can learn more about her and the book and all of our other authors on our Facebook page. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Let us know what you think of the book. By the way, also later on, we're going to post up on the Facebook page a clip from Chanel's website. She has recipes. And so we want to, you know, check out some of those recipes, especially for the key lime pie. And I want to ask the question, by the way, where can I find the best key lime pie in the Keys? Let me know, because next time I go down, I'm going to go look for it. All right, that's our program for this Tuesday, September 22nd. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, the November election is less than 6 weeks away. Both campaigns are working to get out the vote here in Florida. Joe Gruters is the chairman of the Florida GOP, and he played a critical role in the president's 2016 campaign. We're going to hear about Trump's strategy to win Florida. Plus, a recent nationwide survey of Americans under the age of 40 examines their understanding of the Holocaust. And they found that 23% of respondents say they believe the Holocaust was a myth. We're going to hear from State Senator Lauren Book about new legislation to teach the Holocaust in schools. And finally, why are we seeing so many manta rays off the coast of Palm Beach County? We'll tell you why. All of that tomorrow on the program. Remember, stay safe. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.